He testified that he had been instructed by Yanukidze to assist in the murder of Kirov. Although he objected, he said, Yanushche insisted. If anyone in Soviet political life was totally unqualified to insist on anything, it was Yanukidze, a far less powerful figure than Yagoda himself. If we were to substitute for him the name of a man who was in a position to insist, we should not have to look far. Yagoda went on, owing to this, I was compelled to instruct Zaporozhets, who occupied the post of assistant chief of the regional administration of the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs, not to place any obstacles in the way of the terrorist act against Kirov. During Yagoda's cross-examination, things did not go smoothly. Without giving anything away, he yet managed to imply that there was something fishy about the whole business. Asked what methods he used in the other alleged murders, he answered, in any case not such as described here, and when questioned as to whether he would confirm his own testimony at the preliminary investigation, said, it is exaggerated, but that does not matter. When it came to the Kirov murder itself, the following exchange was particularly odd. Yagoda, I gave instructions, Wyshynsky, to whom? Yagoda, to Zaporozhets in Leningrad. That is not quite how it was. Wyshynsky, we shall speak about that later. What I want now is to elucidate the part played by Rykov and Bukharin in this villainous act. Yagoda, I gave instructions to Zaporozhets. When Nikolaev was detained, Wyshynsky, in whose briefcase, Yagoda, there was a revolver and a diary. And he released him. Wyshynsky, and you approved of this? Yagoda, I just took note of the fact. Wyshynsky, and then you gave instructions not to place obstacles in the way of the murder of Sergei Mironovich Kirov? Yagoda, yes, I did. It was not like that. Wyshynsky, in a somewhat different form? Yagoda, it was not like that, but it is not important. In Leningrad, Zaporozhets looked around for a method and found in the files a report on a disillusioned and embittered young communist, Nikolaev. Nikolaev had told a friend that he intended to assassinate some party figure as a protest. The friend had reported him. Through the friend, Zaporozhets got into contact with Nikolaev and saw that he was provided with a pistol. In addition, Zaporozhets got the friend to persuade Nikolaev to select Kirov as his victim. Zaporozhets's next task was to steer his gunmen to the heavily guarded Kirov. As so often in real life, his plans did not run smoothly. The revolver had been got to Nikolaev. He was worked up to assassination pitch. But his attempts to get into the Smolny did not at first succeed. He was arrested twice in that neighborhood. The first time, a month and a half before the killing, that is, within a couple of weeks of Kirov's return from Kazakhstan, he was not even searched. The second time, only a few days before his successful attempt, he got as far as the outer guard in the Smolny. There the guard found on him a revolver and a chart of the route Kirov usually took, according to Yagoda at the 1938 trial, or a notebook and a revolver, according to the evidence of Yagoda's secretary Bolanov on the same occasion. In any case, arms were found on him. But upon Zaporozhets's instructions he was released on both occasions, as Khrushchev was to put it in his speech to the 22nd Party Congress in 1961. It says a good deal for Nikolaev's nerve that he brought himself to make his last, and successful, attempt. Zaporozhets had gone on holiday, leaving the affair in the hands of accomplices, not yet, 1989, identified. Apart from instructions to the outer guard to let Nikolaev through unsearched, the arrangements included the temporary abandonment of the internal guard posts on each floor. They also managed to detain Kirov's bodyguard, Borisov. And finally, after all the earlier muddles, Stalin's plan succeeded, and his colleague lay dead in the Smolny quarters. But there was still much to do. When the news reached Moscow, it was announced to the accompaniment of a strong expression of grief and comradeship for the dead man by Stalin and the Politburo. Stalin, with Voroshilov, Molotov, and Zhdanov, left for Leningrad the same evening to conduct the inquiry. Yagoda, Agranov, and other leading NKVD men accompanied them. Stalin and his entourage took over an entire floor of the Smolny. But before the investigation, there were political moves to be made. An official speaker remarked at the 22nd Party Congress in 1961. On the day of the murder, which at that time had not yet been investigated, of course, upon Stalin's instructions from Leningrad, a law was adopted on an accelerated, simplified and conclusive examination of political cases. This was immediately followed by a wave of arrests and political trials. It is as if they had been waiting for this pretext in order, by deceiving the party, to launch anti-Leninist, anti-party methods of struggle to maintain a leading position in the party and state. It is difficult to see how Stalin could have given instructions from Leningrad on the day of the murder. He traveled by train, and Leningrad and Moscow are 400 miles apart by rail. He could scarcely have arrived earlier than the crack of dawn on 2nd of December, the time given by a Soviet source. The decree is indeed dated 1st of December. Stalin doubtless put it in hand before he left and telephoned after arriving in Leningrad to have it signed by the state authorities and issued. The decree, decided on without consultation in the Politburo, was to be a charter of terror over the following years. It ran. 1. Investigative agencies are directed to speed up the cases of those accused of the preparation or execution of acts of terror. 2. Judicial organs are directed not to hold up the execution of death sentences pertaining to crimes of this category in order to consider the possibility of pardon, because the Presidium of the Central Executive Committee of the USSR does not consider as possible the receiving of petitions of this sort. 3. The organs of the Commissariat of Internal Affairs are directed to execute the death sentence against criminals of the above-mentioned category immediately after the passage of sentences. This was published the following day, and the Politburo, presented with a fait accompli, approved it casually the day after that. This was the first exercise in Stalin's new technique, by which the state of emergency was used to justify personal, and technically unconstitutional, action. In the circumstances, any attempt at disapproval would have been extremely difficult. And thus even what poor guarantees Soviet law gave to enemies of the state were destroyed. On 10 December, new Articles 466-470 of the Code of Criminal Procedure of the RSFSR were enacted to bring it into line. We are told that the extrajudicial bodies set up at this period were instituted on the basis of a draft by Kaganovich. Stalin then turned to the inquiry. He at once discovered various snags. First, Borisov, whose devotion to Kirov was well known, had become suspicious. This was dealt with at once. On 2nd of December, an accident occurred to the automobile which took Borisov to the Smolny. Borisov was killed in the accident, and in this way they got rid of a dangerous witness. Bulanov's evidence in the 1938 trial. This was, much later, interestingly expanded by Khrushchev. When the chief of Kirov's bodyguard was being taken for questioning, and he was to be questioned by Stalin, Molotov, and Voroshilov, the car, as its driver said afterward, was involved in an accident deliberately arranged by those who were taking the man to the interrogation. They said that he died as a result of the accident, even though he was actually killed by those who accompanied him. In this way, the man who guarded Kirov was killed. Later, those who killed him were shot. This was no accident but a carefully planned crime. Who could have done this? A thorough investigation is now being made into the circumstances of this complicated affair. It transpires that the driver of the car in which the chief of Kirov's bodyguard was being taken for questioning is alive. He has said that an NKVD operative sat with him in the cab during the drive. They went in a lorry. It is, of course, very strange why a lorry was used to take the man for questioning, as if no other vehicle could be found for the purpose. Evidently, everything had been planned in advance and in detail. Two other NKVD operatives were in the back of the lorry, together with Kirov's chief bodyguard. The driver continued his story. When they were driving through one street, the man sitting next to him suddenly took the steering wheel from his hands and steered the car directly at a house. The driver regained control of the wheel and steered the car, and it only hit the wall of the house sideways. He was told later that Kirov's chief bodyguard lost his life in this accident. Why did he die when no other person in the car suffered? Why were both officials of the People's Commissariat for Internal Affairs, escorting Kirov's chief bodyguard, later shot? This means that someone wanted to have them liquidated and to remove all traces. Why did Stalin dispose of Borisov in such a roundabout way? It seems that in view of Borisov's known loyalty to Kirov, to have him shot or disappear as an accomplice of Nikolaev's would have aroused instant incredulity in the Leningrad Party organization. It was not until 1938, when such considerations no longer applied, that Borisov was alleged to have been an accomplice. And here we may note that the Khrushchevite version of the Kirov affair, with all its air of throwing fresh light, did not produce any facts incompatible with Stalin's own final version. As we see, on the murder of Borisov, the essentials had emerged as to the 1938 trial. Almost every detail of Yagoda's and Zaporozhye's involvement was given at that trial. Why, then, we may ask, did Khrushchev produce the same material, within substantial additional detail, as though it amounted to a great revelation? The answer clearly is that he meant to imply something further. And this method of dealing with the case, of implication, is the one that was pursued in the Soviet Union from 1956 to 1964. In his secret speech of February 1956, Khrushchev said, "It must be asserted that to this day the circumstances surrounding Kirov's murder hide many things which are inexplicable and mysterious and demand the most careful examination. This was said in the context of an attack on Stalin. But nothing was made explicit. At the 22nd Party Congress in October 1961, Khrushchev said, "This time in public, great efforts are still needed to find out who was really to blame for his death. The more deeply we study the materials connected with Kirov's death, the more questions arise. A thorough inquiry is now being made into the circumstances of this complicated case." The same cautious line was taken by other speakers. But the inquiry was slow to produce results. And in a Pravda article of February 7, 1964, the hint was conveyed by remarking that Kirov represented an obstacle to Stalin's ambitions and going on immediately to add, less than a year had passed after the 17th Congress when a criminal hand cut short life of Kirov. This was a premeditated and carefully prepared crime, the circumstances of which, as N.S. Khrushchev declared at the 22nd Congress, have not yet been fully cleared up. Short of actually saying that Stalin was responsible, an announcement which still seemed to stick in the Soviet throat, it would hardly be possible to make the point more clearly. If we still had to find out who was really to blame, then obviously the case against the previously blamed, Zinoviev and Kamenev, and later the rightists, was no longer sustained. Only one major suspect remained. Stalin's daughter, writing in 1963, rightly speaks of transparent hints then being given in Russia that her father was responsible. And there is no doubt that they were so intended and so taken. Registered trademark. But it was not until 1988 that Yagoda was officially implicated in Stalin, often, though not yet officially, named as mainly responsible. The latest Soviet account concludes, "Stalin's participation in the murder is extremely probable, though there is no documentary confirmation," or, as Khrushchev put it in a section of his memoirs which remained unpublished until mid-1989, Yagoda could only have acted on secret orders from Stalin. With Borisov liquidated, Stalin was left with the major problem, Nikolaev. Leonid Nikolaev had, indeed, been a dupe of Stalin, Yagoda, and Zaporozhye's. But he had also acted on his own beliefs. He has, naturally, been treated in a hostile fashion by every generation of Soviet and of oppositionist commentators, including the present one. And his act, far from bringing any benefit to Russia, was made the excuse for worse tyranny than ever. For these and other reasons, it is not easy to get a clear idea of the 30-year-old tyrannicide. Like many revolutionaries, he seems to have been something of a misfit. He had fought in the Civil War as a teenager, and afterward had been unable to make a successful career amid an increasingly bureaucratic society. A party member since 1920, he had not been known as an oppositionist, and, indeed, seems to have been very hostile to Trotskyism. Nikolaev had been out of work since March 1934. When he seems to have attacked a decision sending him to work outside the city, which he believed to be a piece of bureaucratic intrigue. He had been expelled from the party for this breach of discipline, but his membership had been restored 2 months later on his making a declaration of repentance. After the crime, he had been interrogated by local men before the Moscow delegation arrived, and through some slip had realized that the NKVD had been using him. When he was brought before Stalin, he said so flatly and was removed. Even if he could be tortured into temporary submission, it was out of the question to produce him in open court. Ordering Agranov to follow up the Zinovievite line as best he could, Stalin returned to Moscow and for the moment satisfied himself with other measures to intensify the atmosphere of terror. Back in the capital, Kirov's body lay in state. The highest in the land mounted guard over it in the Hall of Columns. When Stalin saw the corpse, the Soviet press noted, he appeared so overcome by emotion that he went forward and kissed it on the cheek. It would be interesting to speculate on his feelings at that moment. It is a trifle ironic that Zinoviev, too, had just expressed his sorrow over Kirov's death, in an obituary rejected by Pravda, and that at the 1936 trial Vyshinsky was to speak of it in these terms: "The miscreant, the murderer, mourns over his victim." Has anything like it ever occurred before? What can one say, what words can one use fully to describe the utter baseness and loathsomeness of this sacrilege? Perfidy. Duplicity. Cunning. On 4 December it was announced that Medved had been dismissed, and replaced by Agranov, and that he and seven of his subordinates would be brought before a court for their failure to protect Kirov. Zaporozhye's name was not among them. A long list of those arrested in connection with the case in Moscow and Leningrad, all white guards, was given at the same time. Within a few days, trials of these, under the new decree, were announced. In Leningrad, the Stalinist judge I. 0. Machlovich chaired a circuit court of the military collegium which, on 5 December, sentenced 37 named White Guards to death for preparation and organization of terrorist acts against officials of the Soviet regime, and in Moscow a similar session under the even more notorious V.V. Ulrich did the same for 33 others. On 13 December, Ulrich went down to Kiev to preside over the sentencing to death of 28 Ukrainians. They too were charged with organizing acts of terror against officials of the Soviet government, and it was also said that most of them had been apprehended with revolvers and hand grenades. In this Ukrainian case, we chance to know more about those concerned than we do about the victims in Leningrad and Moscow. Although the accused in all three cases were charged with having, in their majority, crossed the frontier from abroad for their terrorist purposes, we find that these Ukrainians were almost all well-known writers and cultural and social workers. Apart from one minor diplomat, and a poet who had visited Germany, they had been living in the Ukraine for years. There was later a brief attack on one of them, the deaf poet Vlasko. These official executions were supplemented by scores of others performed with less formality. Throughout the country, a great wave of arrests swept in thousands of those listed in the NKVD records as in one way or another politically suspect. The period of comparative relaxation was now at an end. The last great assassination and attempted assassination had been in August 1918, when socialist revolutionaries killed Uretsky and wounded Lenin. Following that, Sverdlov had issued a hysterical call for merciless mass terror, adding that there was no doubt that the assassins would turn out to be hirelings of the English and French. In the event, hundreds of prisoners were shot as reprisals. Few Bolsheviks, apart from the brave Ominsky, made any protest. Now that a similar case had arisen, how could they object to the slaughter of a few score White Guards from Leningrad and elsewhere? There was one typical distinction between the two terrors. Stalin implied that the victims of his terror decree were actually associated with the crime, while in Lenin's time those shot had quite frankly been no more than class hostages. Amid this orgy of shootings, the Soviet press was launched into one of those campaigns replete with calls for vigilance and ruthlessness towards the hidden enemy which were to appear at intervals throughout Stalin's life. An atmosphere was created, in fact, in which no voice of even comparative reason or moderation could raise itself. The mutual denunciation sessions in which communists fought for their party membership, and indeed for their lives, by panicky and sycophantic accusations against their own accusers had died down to some considerable extent since 1933. They now revived. The moderate line toward the rank and file opposition was reversed. Thousands who had been readmitted to the party were expelled. In December 1934, a secret letter from the Central Committee, entitled Lessons of the Events Connected with the Evil Murder of Comrade Kirov, was sent to all party committees. It amounted to a call to them to hunt down, expel, and arrest all former oppositionists who remained in the party organizations and was followed by a storm of indiscriminate denunciations. At this early phase in the purge, however, some discrimination was still shown in the action taken on these. Friendship with an exposed Trotskyite usually received a severe reprimand rather than expulsion. Only a few years later, Merle Fainsod comments, such mild punishment would come to be regarded not merely as extreme liberalism, but as clear indication of the complicity of the judges in counter-revolutionary activity. Throughout the month the press attacked Trotskyites discovered in various parts of the Union, censured party organizations for rotten liberalism, and called for vigilance. Mass deportations to Siberia and the Arctic took place. Within a few months 30,000 to 40,000 Leningraders had already been taken. A typical case from the Times, of which dozens might be related, was that of the writer Alexander G. Lebedyenko, who was arrested in Leningrad in January 1935 and exiled. 1.5 years later, that is, in mid-1937, he was sentenced without trial or investigation, by decision of an NKVD troika, to 20 years isolation, and was released after the 20th Congress in 1956. Meanwhile, Agranov had been working on the Zinoviev connection. He established a connection between Nikolaev and the men who had been leading figures in the Leningrad Komsomol during Zinoviev's ascendancy in the city. The most prominent was I.I. Kotalinov, former member of the Central Committee of the Komsomol. It had been Kotalinov who had boldly protested at the Stalinist bully boys who were then taking over the youth organization, saying of them, "They have the mentality, if he is not a Stalinist, put on the screws, let him have it, chase him so hard that he won't open his mouth again." He had, in fact, been a real oppositionist, and one against whom a real grudge persisted. Right through the purge, this was to be a bad combination. Agranov found that Kotalinov and some others of this group had met for discussion in 1934 because the local party institute was talking of producing a history of the Leningrad Komsomol. These meetings, encouraged by Kirov, were quite open and under party control, but unorthodox views had been expressed. Agranov built this up into a conspiracy. Nine other men who had been present, including another former member of the Komsomol Central Committee, Rumyantsev, were arrested. They were under arrest, or some of them were, by 6 December. Severe interrogation methods were employed. Even so, most of the young oppositionists refused to capitulate. This method of dealing with party members was new, and they could not have had the feeling of hopelessness which later set in similar circumstances. On the contrary, the whole thing must have seemed a dangerous and horrible lunacy of the interrogators, which might be overruled at any moment. By 12 to 13 December, Agranov nevertheless had one or two confessions ready. These connected the former oppositionist Komsomols of Leningrad with Kamenev and Zinoviev, who had met their former supporters once or twice in an innocent way. Tilda Akranov's report to Stalin represented this as Kamenev and Zinoviev going back on their various promises to disarm politically and in effect as a sort of conspiracy. When this report came before the Politburo, in an atmosphere of extreme tension, the majority still supported the liberalization envisaged by Kirov. Stalin accepted this warmly, but added that it should be amended at one point. Since the opposition had failed to disarm, the party should in self-defense undertake a check of all former Trotskyites and Zinovievites. This was agreed to with some hesitation, and as to the assassination itself, it was to be left to the investigating authorities. Before the middle of the month, G. E. Yevdokimov, former secretary of the Central Committee, Bakayev, who had been Zinoviev's head of the Leningrad GPU, and others were arrested. Zinoviev then drafted a letter to Yagoda saying that he was disturbed by these arrests and asking to be summoned so that he could establish that he had no connection with the murder. Kamenev dissuaded him from sending it. On 16 December, Pauker, head of the operations department of the NKVD, and Bulanov, Yagoda's personal assistant, arrested Kamenev, and at the same time Molchanov, head of the secret political department, and Volovich, deputy head of the operations department, trademark pulled in Zinoviev. It says something for the respect which leading old Bolshevik oppositionists even then commanded in the party that the routine search was dispensed with. For the first 4 or 5 days after the murder, the press had been full of the demands of workers' meetings for revenge, accounts of Kirov's life, descriptions of his lying in state and his funeral, listings of executed White Guard terrorists, and so on. Then came, for a week or 10 days, a curious pause. But now, on 17 December, the Moscow Committee of the Party passed a resolution to the effect that loathsome, hateful agents of the class enemy, foul dregs of the former Zinoviev anti-party group, have torn Comrade Kirov from our midst, the first public reference to the alleged political feelings behind the murder. The Leningrad Committee, which had just elected Andrei Zhdanov as Kirov's replacement, on 16 December, passed a resolution in almost identical terms. As yet, no NKVD announcement had directly blamed the assassination on anyone but Nikolaev. The White Guards had been vaguely charged with terrorism. On 21 December, it was at last officially stated that Kirov had been murdered by a Leningrad center, headed by Kotalinov, and consisting of him, Nikolaev, and 6 others, all of them categorized as former members of the Zinoviev opposition who had at various times been expelled from the party, though mostly restored to membership after statements of solidarity with the party line. 6 other accomplices were also implicated. On the following day, a list was given for the first time of the arrested Zinovievite leaders, with a decision on the conduct of their cases. There were distinguished names among them, Zinoviev and Kamenev, formerly members of the Politburo, G. E. Yevdokimov, formerly member of the Secretariat, other former members and candidate members of the Central Committee, Zalyutsky, who had formed with Molotov and Shliapnikov the first Bolshevik committee in Petrograd after the February Revolution, Fedorov, Kuklin, Safarov. For the moment, a partial accusation went forward. Regarding 7 of those arrested, including Zinoviev, Kamenev, Zalyutsky, and Safarov, it was announced that the NKVD, lacking sufficient data for bringing them before a court, would take them before a special board, with a view to sending them into administrative exile. With the others, headed by Bakayev, further investigation would take place. It was a typical Stalin move, suitable for gradually getting his colleagues and the party used to the idea of Zinoviev's guilt, and at the same time complicated and confusing enough to mask or blur his real intent. Of the 15 now mentioned, 10 were to appear in the first Zinoviev-Kamenev trial the following month, together with 9 not previously named. On 27 December the formal accusation against the Nikolaev group was published. Now 14 in number, they had allegedly been working since August, keeping a watch on Kirov's flat and office, and deducing his usual movements. Witnesses were mentioned, Nikolaev's wife, Milda Drowley, his brother, and others. The conspirators were accused of having planned to kill Stalin, Molotov, and Kaganovich in addition to Kirov. And Nikolaev was also said to have been passing anti-Soviet material to an unspecified foreign consul, who later turned out to be the Latvian Bisinex, though the NKVD is said to have originally favored his Finnish colleague. The already executed White Guards were vaguely worked in through connections Nikolaev was said to have formed with Denikinists. Documentary evidence was mentioned, including a diary of Nikolaev's and statements he had prepared. Apparently these showed clearly that he had no accomplices. It could not be totally suppressed at this stage, as too many uninitiated investigators and others seem to have seen it. So the official account, mentioning the diary, says that it was a forgery designed to give the impression that there was no conspiracy, but only a protest against the unjust treatment of individuals, or, as a later and fuller version has it. The accused Nikolaev prepared several documents, a diary, declarations addressed to various institutions, etc., in which he tried to represent his crime as a personal manifestation of despair and discontent arising from the aggravation of his material situation and a protest against the unjust attitude of certain members of the government toward a living person. Three volumes of testimony are cited, each of them at least 200 pages long, including various confessions. From all this it might have been expected that the prosecution could have held an open trial. It did not do so. On 28 and 29 December, a court presided over by the ubiquitous Ulrich sat behind closed doors. For the more important of Nikolaev's alleged accomplices seem still to have refused to confess in spite of severe interrogation. There were rumors, to put it no higher, that fellow prisoners had seen Kotalinov at the time of his interrogation, badly scarred and beaten. But he and the other Zinovievite ex-comsomols are said to have resisted to the end. The published announcement of their trial reported the conspirators as saying that their motive for killing Kirov was to replace the leadership with Zinoviev and Kamenev. Nikolaev and all the others were sentenced to death and executed on 29 December. The result so far was not entirely satisfactory to Stalin. The party would still scarcely have accepted a direct incrimination of Zinoviev and Kamenev simply on trust, without the assassin being produced to testify to it in public. Moreover, after the first shock of Kirov's death had died down, a strong element in the Politburo and elsewhere continued to put out Kirov's own line of reconciliation and relaxation. Negotiations were afoot with the imprisoned opposition leaders to get them to assume the entire guilt for reasons of party discipline, but these were unproductive. On the other hand, they began to feel that it was in their own interests to do all they could to discourage terrorism, which could only lead to worse repressions against themselves and their followers. So they finally agreed to accept moral responsibility for the murder, in that the assassin could conceivably have been encouraged to his act by their political attitudes. On 15 and 16 January, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Yevdokimov, Bakayev, Kuklin, and 14 others were brought to trial in Leningrad as the Moscow center. Ulrich again presided, and Vyshinsky prosecuted. The line taken was that, knowing the terrorist inclination of Kotalinov's Leningrad center, those now accused had given it political encouragement. The new trial was not, however, reported fully. Only a three-quarter page summary appeared in the press, with a few quotations from the evidence of Zinoviev and others admitting their partial guilt. The group was said to have been exposed by Bakayev and by Safarov, who was not on trial. Bakayev, who had been under interrogation for over a month, seems to have made the fullest confession. Zinoviev was reported as saying in court, "The former activity of the former opposition could not, by the force of objective circumstances, but stimulate the degeneration of those criminals." He took full responsibility for those he had misled, and summed up by remarking that, "The task that I see confronting me on this subject is to repent fully, frankly and sincerely, before the court of the working class, for what I understand to be a mistake and a crime, and to say it in such a way that it should all end, once and for all, for this group." But though this general acceptance of the moral responsibility of the opposition was made, charges of more sinister involvement were rejected. Kamenev expressed his lack of trust in the witness Safarov. He also stated flatly that he did not know of the existence of the Moscow Center, of which it now turned out he was an active member, though insofar as it existed he took responsibility for it. Zinoviev, too, said that many of those in the dock were unknown to him, and added that he learned of Kotalinov's role only from the indictment in the Leningrad Center case. Trademark. In spite of the partial surrender of the oppositionists, it is clear that their stand was not fully satisfactory to Stalin and that a public trial would not have been a success. On January 16, 1935, Zinoviev was sentenced to 10 years imprisonment, Yevdokimov to 8, Bakayev to 8, and Kamenev to 5. The other sentences ranged from 10 years to 5. At the same time, It was announced that the NKVD Special Board had sentenced 49 people, including Zalyutsky, to confinement to concentration camps for a period of 4 to 5 years, while 29 others, including Safarov, had been sentenced to exile. The length of the sentences was in any case to prove unimportant, as there is no known instance of any of these figures, major or minor, ever being released. 2 days after the trial, January 18, 1935, a further secret circular on vigilance was issued by the Central Committee, an official call to all branches to start rooting out enemies, which significantly condemned lack of vigilance as a re-echoing of the right deviation. A fresh wave of arrests, running into tens of thousands, now struck all the former opposition and other suspects at local levels. There was still one batch of prisoners from the Kirov case left to be dealt with, the Leningrad NKVD leadership, whose forthcoming trial had been announced on 4 December. On 23 January they finally came before a court under, as ever, Ulrich. Instead of the 9 originally charged, there were now 12, and Zaporozhets was among them. Medved and Zaporozhets were charged with failure to observe the basic requirements of state security, in that having received information about the preparations for the attempt on SM Kirov, they failed to take the necessary measures to prevent the assassination, although they had every possible means of arresting it. The sentences were extremely light. One official, Baltsevich, got 10 years for, in addition to the main charge, unspecified wrongful acts during the investigation. Medved got 3 years, and the others either 2 or 3. The sentences were specifically to be served in a Konzlager, concentration camp, a word soon to fall into disuse. These sentences struck observant NKVD officers as totally out of proportion to the charges, especially as those sentenced for mere negligence got 2 years, and those for criminal negligence, apart from Baltsevich, 3 years, only 1 year more. Stalin's natural reaction to a criminal failure to guard against a genuine assassination attempt, of the sort which might strike him next, would have been the exemplary execution of all the NKVD defaulters. In fact, they could scarcely have avoided a charge of complicity in the actual crime. But the whole thing became even odder and more sinister when it was discovered that Medved and Zaporozhets were being treated as though the sentences were little more than a tedious formality. As was later said at the 1938 trial, Yagoda displayed exceptional and unusual solicitude towards them. He had entrusted the care of the families of Zaporozhets and Medved to his personal secretary, Bulanov. He had sent them for detention to the camp in an unusual way, not in the car for prisoners, but in a special through car. Before sending them, he had Zaporozhets and Medved brought to see him. This is, of course, impossible to conceive as a personal initiative of Yagoda's. A higher protection was being provided. Moreover, NKVD officers learned that Pauker and Shannon, head of the NKVD Transport Department, were sending records and radio sets to Zaporozhets in exile. Contrary to the strict Stalinist rule of instantly breaking even with one's best friend, once arrested. After the various odd circumstances of the whole Kirov case, it was this above all which convinced many officials that Stalin had approved, if not arranged, the Kirov killing. The true story gradually filtered through the NKVD apparatus. Even then it was recounted with great reserve. Both Orlov and Krivitsky were told, as the former puts it, the whole affair is so dangerous that it is healthier not to know too much about it. A prisoner from the White Sea Canal camps reports that Medved appeared at the headquarters of the camp complex, arriving by train in a special compartment and being put up by the head of the project, Rapoport, in his own house, where he gave a party for him. Medved was wearing an NKVD uniform without the insignia of his rank. He then went on, in the same style, to Solovetsk. When the ice of the Okhotsk Sea made the move possible, Medved, Zaporozhets, and all the others we can trace were sent to Kolyma, where they were technically prisoners, but in fact given high posts, Zaporozhets as head of the road building administration in the Kolyma complex. As to the final fate of these NKVD exiles, Khrushchev was to remark 20 years later, after the murder of Kirov, top functionaries of the Leningrad NKVD were given very light sentences, but in 1937 they were shot. We can assume that they were shot in order to cover the traces of the organizers of Kirov's killing. Khrushchev's point is fairly taken, but it is too crudely put. No doubt, in a general way, Stalin favored silencing those who knew his secrets. In fact, during the Zinoviev, Kamenev trial of 1936, the accused are represented as planning, after their seizure of power, to put Bakayev in charge of the NKVD with a view to covering up traces by killing all officials who might have knowledge of the plot, and also so that the conspiratorial group could destroy its own activists, its own terrorist gunmen. As the conspiracy was simply an invention of Stalin's with evidence fake to suit, This shows that he thought it natural to shoot NKVD man and others who knew too much. But Stalin could scarcely liquidate everyone who knew of, or suspected, his crimes. It was not practical politics to execute Yagoda's subordinates until there had been time for all sorts of leaks. If it comes to that, several men who were in possession of some of Stalin's worst secrets, like Shkiryatov, Poskrovichev, Vyshinsky, Beria, and Meklis, survived until 1953-1955, while Kaganovich is still alive. It is true that in 1937 a great purge swept the NKVD in Kolyma. Once it was decided to expose Yagoda's part in the Kirov murder, and to tell the whole story of the NKVD involvement, it was time to sacrifice all concerned. At the 1938 trial, Zaporozhye's role was plainly described, and it was announced that he had not appeared in court because he was being made the subject of separate proceedings. This seems to confirm that he was then still alive but that, if such was the case, he would not long remain so. With the January 1935 trial of the Leningrad NKVD chiefs, the Kirov case was wound up, for the time being. The old Zinoviev oppositionists were all in prison. Leningrad had been taken from independent hands and put under Stalin's devoted satrap, Zhdanov. A terror expressed mainly in mass deportations, but partly in mass executions, had struck the city and, to a lesser extent, the country as a whole. Among the victims brought to book in this aftermath, Nikolaev's wife, Milda Drowley, together with Olga Drowley, her sister, and another relative, were tried by the military collegium and were shot on March 10, 1935. The murder of Kirov was indeed the key moment in Stalin's road to absolute power and extreme terror. Eugenia Ginsburg starts her journey into the whirlwind with the sentence "The year 1937 began, to all intents and purposes, at the end of 1934, to be exact, on the 1st of December." As a recent Soviet article puts it, it marked a turning point. Prior to 1st of December there was a chance of better things and the scales of history trembled, but Stalin threw Nikolaev's smoking gun into the scales. Another, in a more formal analysis, agrees, while adding that of course this does not mean that Stalin's action was unpremeditated or that he was now to carry out his whole program immediately. In fact, much remained to be done to crush his opponents entirely and to overcome the resistance of his less enthusiastic allies. The coup de grace had not been given. And meanwhile hostility to his actions was once again arising in the lower levels of the party. In the Komsomol, for example, there was surprisingly frank resistance to Stalinism as late as 1935. The secret archive from Smolensk province reveals the extent of this feeling. In a Komsomol discussion on the Kirov assassination, one member is quoted as saying, "When Kirov was killed, they allowed free trade in bread. When Stalin is killed, all the kolkhozes will be divided up." A Komsomol school director, serving as a propagandist, declared, "Lenin wrote in his will that Stalin could not serve as leader of the party." Another teacher accused Stalin of having transformed the party into a gendarmerie over the people. A 9-year-old pioneer was reported to have shouted, "Down with Soviet power! When I grow up, I am going to kill Stalin." An 11-year-old schoolboy was overheard saying, "Under Lenin we lived well, but under Stalin we live badly." And a 16-year-old student was said to have declared, "They killed Kirov, now let them kill Stalin." There were even occasional expressions of sympathy for the opposition. A worker Komsomol was quoted as saying, "They have slandered Zinoviev enough, he did a great deal for the revolution." A Komsomol propagandist in answer to a question denied that Zinoviev had had any hand in the Kirov affair and described him as an honored leader and cultivated man. An instructor of a district Komsomol committee came out in open support of the views of Zinoviev. In fact, there was much to do before a situation satisfactory to Stalin could be established. Architect of terror. A prince must possess the nature of both beast and man. Machiavelli. The events of December 1934 and January 1935, so horrible, but above all so extraordinary, lead to the question of the mind behind them. The nature of the whole purge depends in the last analysis on the personal and political drives of Stalin. If we have put off any consideration of his personality until after we have seen him in characteristic action, it is because we can recount what he did, and, later, describe the results of the state he brought into being, more easily than we can describe him as an individual. He was not one of those figures whose real intentions were ever openly declared, or whose real motives can readily be deduced. If Stalin's personal drives were the motive force of the purge, it is also true that his ability to conceal his real nature was the rock on which all resistance to the purge foundered. His opponents could not believe that he would either wish to, or be able to, do what he did. Stalin was now 55. Until the age of 37, he had been a not particularly prominent member of a small revolutionary party whose prospects of coming to power in his lifetime even Lenin had doubted as late as 1916. When the revolution came, Stalin appeared to be outshone by many glittering contemporaries. The time since had been spent in ceaseless political maneuver. As a result, he had defeated in turn every rival, and had now been for 5 years the undisputed head of state and party. He had lately had his methods put to the severest test in the collectivization campaign and, against all prediction, had won through. This had not proved enough for him. Contrary to all that Marx had thought, we shall find in the Soviet Union of the Stalin epoch a situation in which the economic and social forces were not creating the method of rule. On the contrary, the central factor was ideas in the mind of the ruler impelling him to action very often against the natural trend of such forces. An idealist conception of history was for once correct. For Stalin created a machine capable of taking on the social forces and defeating them, and infused it with his will. Society was reconstructed according to his formulas. It failed to reconstruct him. As the physicist Alexander Weisberg, himself a victim of the Great Purges, points out, a Marxist view of history, and, one might say, any sociological interpretation of politics, has its validity restricted to systems which allow of the application of the statistical conception, just as with the other true sciences. When a society is so organized that the will of one man, or a small group, is the most powerful of the political and social forces, such explanations must give way, at least to a very considerable degree, to a more psychological style. And so we are driven to an examination of the individual Joseph Stalin. But, as Arthur Kessler remarks, what went on in no eyes brain? What went on in the inflated gray worlds? One knew everything about the faraway spiral nebulae, but about them nothing. That was probably the reason that history was more of an oracle than a science. Perhaps later, much later, it would be taught by means of tables of statistics, supplemented by such anatomical sections. The teacher would draw on the blackboard an algebraic formula representing the conditions of life of the masses of a particular nation at a particular period. Here, citizens, you see the objective factors which condition this historical process. And, pointing with his ruler to a gray foggy landscape between the second and third lobes of number one's brain, now here you see the subjective reflection of these factors. It was this which in the second quarter of the 20th century led to the triumph of the totalitarian principle in the east of Europe. Until this stage was reached, politics would remain bloody dilettantism, mere superstition and black magic. 993. Stalin's head had a solid peasant look about it, but his face was pockmarked and his teeth were uneven. His eyes were dark brown with a tinge of hazel. He had a stiff left arm and shoulder, the result of an accident when he was about 10. His torso was short and narrow, and his arms were too long. Like many ambition-driven men, he was very short, only about 5 feet, 3 inches. He raised himself an inch or so by specially built shoes, and at the May Day and 7th of November parades stood on a wooden slab, which gave him another inch or two, Bukharin said. It even makes him miserable that he cannot convince everyone, including himself, that he is a taller man than anybody else. That is his misfortune. It may be his most human trait and perhaps his only human trait. His reaction to his misfortune is not human, it is almost devilish. He cannot help taking revenge for it on others, but especially those who are in some way better or more gifted than he is. 4. Such psychological science as we have would turn also to Stalin's childhood. W. H. Auden wrote of the origins of another dictatorship. Accurate scholarship can unearth the whole offense. And not only in the history of a country, but in the early life of a dictator, find what occurred at Linz, but it seems doubtful if it will ever be possible really to trace what occurred at Gori, where Stalin was born and grew up, in anything like the detail implied. In any case, the necessary type of research, the free questioning of relatives and contemporaries and others in the area, has not been possible. Even if it were soon to become so, it is by now presumably too late. Not that any definitive and generally accepted psychological study of the formation even of Hitler has emerged either. A fortiori, on the little and dubious evidence before us in Stalin's case, it would seem best not to venture even the sketchiest reconstruction. There are, anyhow, probably few historians today who would care to deduce the essentials of a personality from a few second-hand reports about a long past childhood. With Stalin, moreover, the bare facts are in dispute. His father was, according to some accounts, a worthless drunkard; according to others, this was not so. The biographers are faced with pursuing the matter, but in the circumstances we may be excused. This is a pity, in a way, For if it were possible to describe with rigor a set of childhood conditions likely to produce a Stalin, worldwide legislation to prevent their recurrence would be a laudable enterprise. Legends clung even about his birth. Georgians, anxious for the reputation of their country, represented him as really of Tatar or Ossetian origin. In the period of his greatness, there was a story that he was the illegitimate son of a Georgian prince. Other putative fathers include the explorer Przhevolsky and, more plausibly, a local merchant. At any rate, his accepted father was a peasant cobbler, who treated him either well or badly, for as early as this, discord descends on the accounts. His father died when he was 11, leaving a hard-working and strong-minded mother to bring up the boy. When nearly 15, Stalin left the Gori Elementary School for the Theological Seminary at Tbilisi, being expelled, or removed for health reasons, when he was 19. This was in 1899. He had already joined the party circles in which he was to pass the remainder of his life, and by 1901 had given up all other activity to become a professional revolutionary. His early life in the social democratic organizations in the Caucasus is still a very obscure subject. The Trotskyite line, that he was unimportant and inactive, is clearly exaggerated. The hagiological stories which appeared in the 1930s and 1940s representing Stalin as a Lenin of the Caucasus are even more baseless. But he seems at least to have been elected a member of the executive of the All-Caucasus Federation of the Social Democratic Party in 1903. The whole early history of the Bolsheviks in Transcaucasia has been thoroughly obfuscated by a series of historians. The main point is that Bolshevism never struck root in Georgia, and most of those who later became Bolsheviks were little more than occasionally mutinous hangers-on of the large and efficient Menshevik organization. When, after the failure of the 1905 revolution, Lenin started to rely on bank robbery as a source of funds for the party, Stalin was involved in organizing raids on banks in the Caucasus, though he never directly took part in them. At this time, these expropriations were being widely condemned in the European and the Russian Social Democratic movement, and Trotsky, among others, was pointing to the demoralization involved. Even Lenin saw this to some degree, and attempted to bring the fighting squads under strict control and to eliminate the semi-bandit elements which had got into them. But Stalin seems to have had no qualms of any sort. However, after his rise to power, nothing was ever said about this activity. Whatever Lenin's tactical qualms, this ruthlessness appealed to him, and in 1912 Stalin was co-opted onto the Central Committee of the party. Thenceforward, in Siberian exile or at the center of power, he remained a high though unobtrusive figure in the Bolshevik leadership. In Lenin's last days, his estimate of the wonderful Georgian changed. He said of him, "This cook's dishes will be too peppery." Trotsky tells us, plausibly enough, that Lenin admired Stalin for his firmness and his direct mind, but finally saw through his ignorance, his very narrow political horizon, and his exceptional moral coarseness and unscrupulousness. It was on grounds of personal unpleasantness, not of political unreliability, that he urged Stalin's removal, not from positions of power, but from the particular post of General Secretary. Only at the very last, too late, did Lenin plan Stalin's ruin. At about the same time, Stalin is reported as saying to Kamenev and Dzerzhinsky, "To choose one's victims, to prepare one's plans minutely, to slake an implacable vengeance, and then to go to bed, there is nothing sweeter in the world." This often quoted story is entirely in accord with Stalin's practice, but it is perhaps a little unlikely that he would have spoken in quite these terms in front of possible, and not yet forewarned, rivals. His opponents, on the whole, only realized his implacability too late. But it is unnecessary today to labor the point of Stalin's unscrupulousness or yet the extreme vindictiveness of his nature. The Stalin method of argument, long prevalent in the Soviet Union, can be traced as early as his first articles in 1905. Its particular marks are expressions like "as is well known," "etak izvestno," used in lieu of proof to give weight to some highly controversial assertion, and "it is not accidental," "ne slučajno," used to assert a connection between two events when no evidence, and no likelihood, of such a connection exists. These and similar expressions became the staple of Soviet speeches in Stalin's time, and after. Such phrases are extraordinarily illustrative and significant. A statement like "as is well known," "Trotskyites are Nazi agents" is difficult to object to in an authoritarian state, while the idea that nothing is accidental, a strictly paranoid formulation, makes it possible to construe every fault and weakness as part of a conscious plot. This attitude accords with Stalin's notoriously suspicious nature. Khrushchev tells us, "Stalin was a very distrustful man, sickly suspicious. We knew this from our work with him. He could look at a man and say, 'Why are your eyes so shifty today?' Or why are you turning so much today and avoiding looking me directly in the eyes? The sickly suspicion created in him a general distrust even toward eminent party workers whom he had known for years. Everywhere. And in everything he saw enemies, double dealers and spies. A result of this attitude was that he almost never let down his guard. In politics, particularly in those of the sharpest style, this was to prove an excellent tactical principle. We cannot know how far Stalin really cherished the principles he professed. Khrushchev, in his secret speech of February 1956, concluded a series of appalling revelations of terror by remarking of them that Stalin was convinced that it was necessary for the defense of the interests of the working class against the plotting of the enemies and against the attack of the imperialist camp. He saw this from the position of the working class, the interests of the working people, the interests of the victory of socialism and communism. We cannot say that these were the deeds of a giddy despot. He considered that this should be done in the interests of the party, of the working masses, in the name of defense of the revolution's gains. In this lies the whole tragedy. Most people would not perhaps regard it as the whole tragedy. But, more to our point, there is no way of telling what Stalin's true motivation was. The fact that to all appearances he took the view attributed to him by Khrushchev does not prove that he held it sincerely. Whether he consciously thought of the state of things he created and found good as the socialism taught in his youth, or whether he saw it as an autocracy suitable to his own aims and to Russian reality, we cannot say. A Soviet Air Force expert who had attended a number of meetings with the top Soviet leadership in connection with plans for an intercontinental rocket mentioned Stalin saying that the project would make it easier for us to talk to the great shopkeeper Harry Truman and keep him pinned down where we want him, but then turning to him with a curious remark, "You see, we live in an insane epoch." None of the Soviet leaders of the time was ever reported as expressing in private anything but a straightforward and cynically put desire to crush the West. This philosophical comment certainly goes deeper. Whether it represents Stalin's real thinking and self-justification, or is a sign of that sensitivity to the attitude of others occasionally reported of him, cannot be guessed. When Litvinov was discarded in 1947, he used to meet regularly with his old friend Suritz, another of the rare survivors of the old Soviet diplomatic service. They frequently discussed Stalin. They both agreed that he was a great man in many ways. But he was unpredictable. And he was stubborn, refusing to consider facts which did not correspond to his wishes. He imagined, they thought, that he was serving the people. But he did not know the people and did not wish to know them, preferring the abstract idea the people, made up to his own liking. For what it is worth, the evidence seems to be that Stalin really believed that the abolition of incomes from capital was the sole necessary principle of social morality, excusing any other action whatever. Gielis's summary is perhaps correct. All in all, Stalin was a monster who, while adhering to abstract, absolute and fundamentally utopian ideas, in practice had no criterion but success, and this meant violence, and physical and spiritual extermination. Except for the priceless, though limited, light thrown on it by Stalin's daughter's books, the more personal side of his character must remain to a large degree enigmatic. But it seems that the human moments, few as they were, arose in connection with his wives. When the first, Ekaterina Svinidze, died, a friend who went to the cemetery with him says that he remarked, "This creature softened my stony heart. She is dead and with her died my last warm feelings for all human beings." His second wife, Nadezhda Aleluyeva, held to the old revolutionary ideas. She is said to have become horrified with what she had learned of the sufferings of the collectivization campaign. She seems to have obtained most of her information from students at a course she had been allowed to take, and they were arrested as soon as Stalin found out. Her suicide on November 9, 1932 took place as the result of the last series of violent quarrels with her husband, whom she accused of butchering the people. All early accounts agree that Stalin lost his temper with her and cursed her in front of his friends, though this is somewhat toned down in the version later given to his daughter. For if Nadezhda, following Ekaterina, touched him in a comparatively soft spot, it was not as soft as all that, and remarkable only in comparison with his usual conduct. She left him a letter which wasn't purely personal. It was partly political as well. We are told that this made him think, and, of course, rightly, that he had enemies everywhere, and that it much exacerbated his suspiciousness. Stalin seems to have been deeply affected by Nadezhda's death. He felt it for the rest of his life, blaming it on enemies, and on Michael Arlen, whose book The Green Hat she had been reading at the time. Nadezhda's brother, the old Bolshevik Paul Aluev, was political commissar of the armored forces. After a time, he was put under special surveillance. Later he told an old acquaintance that he was being kept away from Stalin and had his Kremlin pass taken from him. It was clear to him that Yagoda and Pauker had suggested that he might be personally dangerous to Stalin in revenging his sister. He was removed from his post in 1937 and given a minor job in the Soviet trade delegation in Paris. The causes of his early death in 1937 have been variously interpreted, but his wife was later given 10 years for allegedly poisoning him. An interesting family sidelight arises too in Stalin's attitude toward his younger son, Vasily. With his elder son, Yakov, by his first wife, he was always on poor terms, occasionally subjecting him to minor persecutions. The feeling was mutual. With Vasily, Nadezhda Aleluyeva's son, his attitude was quite different. The young man is described with contempt and detestation by all who came in contact with him. He was a stupid bully, a semi-literate drunkard, a beastly pampered schoolboy let out into the world for the first time. In spite of a very poor record at the Kokhinsky Flying School, where he received special tuition, he was passed into the Soviet Air Force without a single bad mark, and by the time he was 29 was already a lieutenant general. In his intemperate outbursts, he invariably traded on his father's name. But Stalin finally removed Vasily from his command for drunken incompetence. And it does not seem that he ever intervened directly to advance his career. It was rather that his subordinates did not dare to do other than recommend the young man enthusiastically in spite of his lack of qualifications. All the same, there seems to be a faint echo here of Napoleonic vulgarities. H. G. Wells writes of Napoleon's relation to the French Revolution. And now we come to one of the most illuminating figures in modern history, the figure of an adventurer and a wrecker, whose story seems to display with an extraordinary vividness the universal subtle conflict of egoism, vanity and personality with the weaker, wider claims of the common good. Against this background of confusion and stress, this stormy and tremendous dawn, appears this dark little archaic personage, hard, compact, capable, unscrupulous, imitative, and neatly vulgar. Many people have felt something of the same about the squat, vulgar figure of Stalin against the tremendous dawn of the Russian Revolution. But, in the first place, Wells is more than a little unfair to Napoleon. His political, as well as military, talents were considerable. Doubtless the emperor vulgarized the revolution, but it had already vulgarized itself. No doubt all revolutions are doomed to vulgarization. But the idealization of the first glories of the new regime often contains a large element of vulgar sentimentalism, and the change to vulgar cynicism may constitute only a comparative deflation. Both Napoleon and Stalin, however, that may be, established their rule largely, though not entirely, by to some degree replacing the motivation of general ideas by that of careerism and personal loyalty. Napoleon was, of course, a vain man. Stalin's vanity has also been much remarked on. But it did not, at least until his last years, run to palatial ostentation. Until the Second World War, he dressed with traditional Bolshevik modesty in a plain brown military coat and dark trousers stuffed into leather boots. He lived unpretentiously in a small house in the Kremlin, formerly part of the Tsar's servants' quarters. Ownership and money as such played no part in his life. In the 1930s, his official salary was about 1,000 rubles a month, in purchasing power, perhaps $40. One of his secretaries accepted and dealt with this small sum, paying the superintendent of the Kremlin a modest rent for his apartment, and dealing with his party dues, his payment for his holiday, and so on. He owned nothing but had immediate right to everything, like the Dalai Lama or the Mikado in the old days. His country villa at Borovica and his seaside government summer house No. 7 at Sochi were state property. With all this personal simplicity, Stalin's reputation for envious emulation arose early among his colleagues. When the Order of the Red Banner began to be awarded in the Civil War, and was to be given to Trotsky, Kamenev proposed that Stalin should receive it too. Kalinin, the new head of state, asked in surprise, "For what?" Bukharin intervened, "Can't you understand? This is Lenin's idea. Stalin cannot live unless he has what someone else has. He will never forgive it." In the final stages of the cult of personality, he was built up with the most astonishing adulation as a genius not only in politics, but also in strategy, the sciences, style, philosophy, and almost every field. His picture looked down from every hoarding, his bust was carried by Soviet alpinists to the top of every Soviet peak. He was elevated to be, with Marx, Engels, and Lenin, the fourth of the great political geniuses of the epoch. The histories were, of course, rewritten to make his role in the revolution a decisive one. Khrushchev describes him inserting in a draft of his own short biography the following passage: "Although he performed his task as leader of the party and the people with consummate skill and enjoyed the unreserved support of the entire Soviet people, Stalin never allowed his work to be marred by the slightest hint of vanity, conceit or self-adulation. Khrushchev goes on to say. In the draft of his book appeared the following sentence, Stalin is the Lenin of today. This sentence appeared to Stalin to be too weak, so, in his own handwriting, he changed it to read, Stalin is the worthy continuer of Lenin's work, or, as it is said in our party, Stalin is the Lenin of today. You see how well it is said, not by the nation but by Stalin himself. I will cite one more insertion made by Stalin concerning the